reign of Israel's longest-serving prime minister has come to an end. Prime Minister Netanyahu is out. Naftali Bennett is in. Who is Naftali Bennett? What changes, if any, will we see in Israel, especially its foreign policy? And will it make a difference in the lives of Palestinians in the Gaza Strip or in the occupied territories? In this edition of The Debate, we will look at Naftali Bennett's past service, especially in the role of Minister of Military Affairs, in which he prides himself on how gruesomely it handled Palestinians.
After more than a decade, Israel has turned the page of Benjamin Netanyahu's rule, ushering in a new era with a new coalition cabinet led by Naftali Bennett, the head of the right-wing Yamina party, and Yair Lapid, the leader of Yesh Atid party. However, the Palestinian leadership remains skeptical, saying it expects no changes in Israeli policy towards Palestinians. It says the only difference that could be seen is that former Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu will no longer be there. Palestinian officials say they expect the Bennett-Lapid cabinet to be worse than the one it's replacing.
Israel's policies won't change even if a new coalition is taking office. There is no hope for change from the Bennett rule. In my opinion, it's more extreme than the one it's replacing. Bennett is likely to pursue the same right-wing agenda as Netanyahu. And here comes the role of the international community to prevent future aggression and violence against the Palestinians.
Bennett, a former chairman of the Yesha Settlers Council, has long vowed to prevent the establishment of an independent Palestinian state, and he supports the annexation of major parts of the occupied West Bank, as well as expanding settlement construction. Experts say Bennett doesn't believe in a solution to the Palestinian-Israeli conflict and will continue to act this way even if he's not an opposition leader anymore, or at least supposed to be.
As a prime minister, Bennett will continue to act what he was doing as an opposition leader. We will be witnessing the same policies such as Israeli expansionist agenda, its stringing of settlements and aggression on the Gaza Strip. And those policies will lead to more tensions and violence across the region.
Israel's new cabinet held a festive first meeting Sunday night following a historic Knesset vote, with 60 members voting in favor, 59 against and one abstaining. Bennett urged his ministers to show restraint over the numerous ideological differences between parties in alliance to ensure its stability. Bennett will serve as prime minister first as part of a rotation agreement with Lapid. He will serve alternately as prime minister and foreign minister until the handover of power to Lapid on 27th of August 2023. Experts warn that in an attempt to prolong the life of the new fragile eight-party coalition, Naftali Bennett, the new Israeli prime minister, will exert every possible effort to appease the most extreme elements, especially through the continuation of settlement activities across the occupied territories. Mona Kandil, Occupied Ramallah.
Our guest joining us for this edition of The Debate, author and researcher Daniel Yejish, joins us from Beirut, and we have political analyst Tariq Tahboub, who joins us from Amman. I'd like to welcome you both. Let me go to our guest first in Amman, Tariq, and ask you, who is Naftali Bennett? And what differences does he have with the previous prime minister or prime ministers, should I say?
Well, Naftali Bennett has been known to the Palestinians, and he has been the former chief of staff of Netanyahu and his military secretary during Netanyahu as prime minister. He's more extremist. There is nothing right about him. Right-wing doesn't apply. Right-wing even to a wing doesn't apply. They are both extremists, egomaniacs, extortionists, ethnic cleansing, and land-grabbing politicians. He is more extreme and dangerous than Benjamin Netanyahu. We are pleased to see Netanyahu leave, hopefully for prison, because he's a corrupt politician as well as a war criminal. But that joy was marred by getting what was more of a war criminal. He is on record saying that he has killed many Arabs and many Palestinians, and he has no qualms about it. His right-hand lady is Aylat Shakid, I think. Yeah, and she's more extreme than him. She has called for the genocide of Palestinian babies and killing of Palestinian mothers because they give birth to snakes. This is the kind of politicians that this genocidal ethnic cleansing occupation is being led by.
Well, Daniel Yedrich, maybe those are the qualifications to make you prime minister when it comes to that position in Israel. Some of the things that our guests there mentioned. I mean, what are your thoughts on this, especially the fact that you have a coalition that, based on the amount of influence it has in decision-making, is very fragile in its structure?
I agree with that. It is absolutely the qualification one needs to have to be the prime minister of the Zionist entity, which is a colonial project that is based on the ethnic cleansing and genocidal erasure of Palestinians from their land. And I think Bennett can be seen as an epitome of this very project. He's someone who has advocated the expansion of settlements, annexation, has bragged about how many Arabs he killed in his life, and that he's proud about that, and saw no problem in that. So in many ways, he symbolizes the very very violent core of the Zionist project. And then if we look at the political spectrum in the Zionist entity, there are different realizations of Zionism and different parties, but at the core of it, at a structure, these are all politicians who support the expansion of settler colonialism in Palestine and even beyond. And I think Bennett is another example of someone who has infiltrated into Lebanon on several occasions, has been responsible, has been an officer during the brutal and illegal Israeli military occupation of South Lebanon. He had a role in the Qana massacre, invaded again in 2006 during Israel's brutal war against Lebanon. So in many ways, he also shows the transnational dimensions of this terrorist regime.
You talked about the Qana massacre, and that was a big one back in 1996, where you had 100 civilians and UN peacekeepers that were involved there in the way that it was carried out. So that kind of fits the description, Tariq, of what you have said and the way that you've described Naftali Bennett. Tell us, if you can, your understanding as to why this coalition that has been formed is so fragile.
Well, the only unification point of this coalition is hate of Netanyahu, the corrupt war criminal, and wanting to dispose with him because, you know, Sagar and Bennett are both lieutenants of Netanyahu, and they are the backbone behind the extremist parties joining Yair Lapid and doing this coalition. But let us remember, as your guest said, there is no difference between left and right in Israel. It's a colonial project. Land grabbing was done during labor governments more than it was done in Likud governments. Palestinians were killed at the hands of labor governments as much as they were killed in Likud governments. They are just trying to appease their crowds by adding more to their resume and their CVs. The number of Palestinian casualties, the number of massacres that they have committed. This is how you advance in the Zionist politics. So it's a race between two war criminals or a contest between two criminals. And if you remember that famous scene in Sheikh Jarrah, Bun al-Kurd's house, when this chap, the Zionist, I don't call them settlers, they are land grabbers and thieves, came to Bun al-Kurd's house and she told him, "You are stealing my house." He said, "If I don't steal it, somebody else will steal it." And the difference between Netanyahu and Bennett is if Netanyahu doesn't kill Palestinians, then Naftali Bennett will kill more. That's the rate in Zionist politics, and this is their project. Look at his party manifesto. Advancement of land grabbing. I don't call them settlements. They are illegal outposts and land grabbing. They are under international law, a crime against international law, and they are not recognized by any government. While we hear lip service from the United States and the European Union about two-state solution, his manifesto is grabbing all land in what is called land C or area C of the Oslo Agreement. He is determined and show the ugliness of the Jewish law that's passed as Israel and the Jewish state in Jerusalem. He has approved the march, what's called the flag march, which right. The Even Netanyahu postponed it because he know what it will lead to tomorrow. It's the march at 6:30 from Bab al-Amud in Jerusalem, the flag march, and it will be a hot flash point because Palestinians and Jerusalemites will fight for their rights.
Right.
They are freedom-loving people. They are entitled to that by international law and
okay.
by all freedom-loving people.
Let me ask Daniel about this march, which is said to be one of the first tests, Daniel Jedzic, that Naftali Bennett is going to have to face. Based on what our guest there said, if once this march takes place and if there's going to be anything that's going to happen during this march, which all signs are pointing that it will, how do you think Naftali Bennett is going to handle it?
Well, that has been going on so far as well. This is, again, not an exception. It's just another way of for Zionists to show their presence in Jerusalem in territories that are illegally occupied under international law. And all of these provocations and manifestations of the settler colonial regime, of course, are what Israel is all about. It's very closely connected to the idea of expanding the settlements and effectively just trying to physically take away the space from Palestinians in any way possible, be it by kicking them out of their homes, protesting in front of them. So it would definitely be another way for Bennett maybe to consolidate his power amongst his voters, which again are effectively, even if their ideological streams within them are might be different, but it goes back to the same structure, which is a colonialist and supremacist one that oppresses and suppresses Palestinians and sees them as less than human and as people who are not deserving of human rights or living in their homes.
Tariq, some of the objectives by Naftali Bennett, based on the types of actions that he's participated in, it includes not ruling out a Palestinian state. He wants to maintain ultimate control over all the land, and he is known as a settler leader, and he's called for Israel to be more forceful when it comes to attacks on the Gaza Strip, which are some of the things that you have said. Now, what's very interesting is that that's his resume, that's his report card, and yet you have the congratulatory messages coming through. Well, the U.S. doesn't count, really. I mean, the U.S. already is a staunchest ally. But, you know, when it comes from the EU or from European countries, such as the European Council president, that he was looking forward to strengthening the EU-Israel partnership, isn't that a way just reconfirming the actions which are illegal that Naftali Bennett is going to be doing now that he's in that position as prime minister?
The whole colonial project is legal under international law, and if you go back to the International Court of Justice rulings and the Security Council and the United Nations General Council, there are so many decisions which have been taken, and they were stopped by the United States veto. Biden took office and says he wants peace and he wants two-state solution, which is a mirage now and just a lip talk. The same day he said this, he provided the Zionist entity with $735 million of new hardware to attack Gaza. They have attacked Gaza, an open prison which is just 300 kilometers. And Gaza used to be a beach resort. All those people who are living in Gaza and cramped in this open prison are the refugees who came from Ashkelon, Ashkelon and Ashdod and the area surrounding Gaza, what is called the southern belt. These people, the Zionist entity has thrown death, destruction, disease, deprivation and degradation on the Palestinians, and to no avail, because the majestic capital defiance, the majestic capital D of defiance, the Palestinian defiance, will swallow all of that. And I can see very soon that the Son of Freedom will rise of the children of Gaza, will rise of the children of Palestine, will rise of the children of Jerusalem and a free Palestine. No matter changing faces, Bennett, Netanyahu, the colonial Zionist project is collapsing and it carries inside itself, like this government, the roots of its destruction, because it is against international law, it's against humanity, uh-huh. and it's against faith, including Judaism. Look at the people of La Torre Carta heading the marches in Brooklyn, New York, carrying "Say No to Zionism." We want Palestine to be completely free. These are Jews who are embracing true Judaism. We have no problem with Judaism.
Right.
It's this colonial land grabbing, ethnic cleansing, murderer ideology that we're facing, and we will break it.
So, Daniel, let's at least look at what has unfolded here. I mean, after all, 12 years of Netanyahu, the world was accustomed to what he was doing in the occupied territories. Any chance that there's going to be a push of any kind coming through, not from the U.S., but from any other countries in particular, from the EU, for example, that perhaps they're going to push Naftali Bennett into stopping some of the violations taking place in the occupied territories. I mean, Naftali Bennett was in his previous post as Minister of Military Affairs, so one way or another he was involved in this 11-day war. One way or another, he's involved with the decision-making that took place in terms of settlements, et cetera, even though he wasn't prime minister at the time. Do you think there's a chance that there may be a change there?
The emergence now of Bennett as the new prime minister has just given the European Union yet another chance to whitewash Israel's crimes and those of its politicians on their behalf. It is quite interesting that Bennett is in his rhetoric rather open about his hatred of Palestinians, about supporting all sorts of human rights violations and violations of international law, including the expansion of settlements, which the European Union is, at least on paper, opposed to, and at the same time gets praise from European Union unelected bureaucrats as well as politicians who have sent all sorts of enthusiastic messages today, looking forward to deepening their ties with Israel and so on. And even this EU commissioner for the what they call Middle East peace process has said that he looks forward to working towards peace, and it's very detached from the actual situation on the ground. There is no peace process, and Bennett would probably be the last who would support such a step. So here, it is just another occasion for the European Union to show what a failure it actually is and its policies and its presence in Palestine, and through its non-existent approach towards Palestinians actually facilitates the expansion of Israeli violence and violations of international law on behalf of Israel, while not doing that as openly. But I think so. Definitely, there's not going to be any shift in their rhetoric or any actions.
Okay. And final question, Tariq, to you. Palestinian Prime Minister has come out and made a couple statements here, saying one of them that the ousting of Netanyahu closes one of the worst periods of the Israeli-Palestinian conflict. How was it one of the worst periods, especially when his predecessors have been accused of the same?
Yes. And Netanyahu was the longest-serving prime minister, and he presided over many massacres of Palestinians and many land grabbing, and his premiership has been marred by the blood of innocent Palestinians, people killed at checkpoints, pregnant ladies cannot go to hospitals, the destruction of the whole health care system in Gaza. They said that we left Gaza. Gaza has been under siege for 12 years now. They control everything, the sea. They don't let boats fish around Gaza. They control anything. Gaza is under siege for 12 years. Imagine that, two million people living in an open prison. So Netanyahu, Bennett, Perez, they are just names to a long list of war criminals in a colonial, racist, narcissist blood superiority
right.
over others, and this is totally unacceptable, by the way. By the way, for the European Union, the European Union is a toothless power. They can solve the problem of Northern Ireland, not the problem, the solve of solving the problem of the worst racist ethnic cleansing occupation in the
okay.
whole world.
Thank you very much for that. We appreciate it. Tariq Tahboub from Amman, political analyst, and Daniel Yejic, thank you, author and researcher from Beirut. With that, we come to an end this edition of The Debate. From Mikhail Tahboub, entire team in the capital of Tehran, is goodbye.
Insights into the Holy Quran.
Indeed, this Quran guides to what is most upright and gives the good news to the faithful who do righteous deeds, that there is a great reward for them.
In the name of Allah, the Compassionate, the Merciful, dear listeners of IRIB English Radio, Assalamu Alaikum. Welcome to another edition of the program, Insights into the Holy Quran, by Sayyid Muhammad Hassan Mudarrisi, a graduate of the Hawza Seminary of Qom. Please stay with us.
أعوذ بالله من الشيطان الرجيم بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم. In the name of Allah, the Beneficent, the Merciful. Hello everyone, dear brothers and sisters. I am Sayyid Muhammad Hassan Mudarrisi, and we're with you with another edition of the program Insights into the Holy Quran. In this edition of the program, we'll be discussing the commentary of the 23rd chapter of the Holy Quran, Suratul Mu'minun, or the Believers. Now let's just listen to the related verses, and then we'll be back. So stay with us.
Bismillahir Rahmanir Rahim.
In the name of Allah, the entirely merciful, the especially merciful.
وَلَئِنْ أَطَعْتُمْ بَشَرًا مِثْلَكُمْ إِنَّكُمْ
And if you should obey a man like yourselves, indeed, you would then be losers.
أَيَعِدُكُمْ أَنَّكُمْ إِذَا مِتُّمْ وَكُنْتُمْ تُرَابًا وَعِظَامًا أَنَّكُمْ
Does he promise you that when you have died and become dust and bones, that you will be brought forth once more?
Hayyata, hayyata lima tu'adud.
How far is that which you are promised?
The next three verses are to be explained together in this program. وَلَئِنْ أَطَعْتُمْ بَشَرًا مِثْلَكُمْ إِنَّكُمْ إِذًا لَخَاسِرُونَ. And if you obey a mortal like yourselves, verily you will be losers. أَيَعِدُكُمْ أَنَّكُمْ إِذَا مِتُّمْ وَكُنْتُمْ تُرَابًا وَعِظَامًا أَنَّكُمْ مُخْرَجُونَ. Does he promise that when you are dead and have become dust and bones, you will indeed be raised?
هيهات هيهات لما توعدون. Far, very far is what you are promised. So, you remember in the previous program, the chiefs of the disbelievers and also the aristocrats started answering the reasonings of the prophets by misleading the people and telling them that since he, the prophet, is the one who eats like you and he drinks what you drink, he is immortal like you. He is nothing but a mortal and he is not a prophet. The unbelievers and the polytheists believe that following the prophets bring loss to mankind. They rather want that people submit to themselves and with the slogan of liberty drive people into slavery. So they say, وَلَئِنْ أَتَعْتُمْ بَشَرًا مِثْلَكُمْ إِنَّكُمْ إِذًا لَخَاسِرُونَ. If you obey a mortal like yourselves, you will be losers. These blind-hearted people were probably not aware that they themselves expected people to follow their evil ideas and united together to struggle against this prophet. They saw following someone guided by the center of revelation, whose heart was illuminated by the light of divine knowledge, as a defect and a flaw, and they thought that this is standing against human freedom and liberty. The next verse points to the fact that their real argument against religion was the denial of resurrection. They knew that if the resurrection were accepted, it would prove a hindrance to the achievement of the goals of their appetites, and they thought that this would stop them from reaching their social ambition. They said, أَيَعِدُكُمْ أَنَّكُمْ إِذَا مِتْتُمْ وَكُنْتُمْ تُرَابًا وَعِظَامًا أَنَّكُمْ مُخْرَجُونَ. Does he promise you that when you are dead and have become dust and bones, you will indeed be raised?
We hope and pray that Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala blesses us with the ability to cover more of His divine
In this
word.
Series of programs, we will inshallah discuss the Holy Quran with a thematic
approach. We will inshallah discuss the chapter.
وتمثل القرآن في أخلاقه وفعاله فيه الفؤاد تعلقا وتلاه في جنح الدجى متدبرا.
The context in which Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala speaks in this verse is the context of mentioning the ills and problems and evils of the people of the book, the previous nations who have received revelation, and more particularly the Jew.
Now let's listen to some of the verses of the Holy Quran.
First, let's listen to a few verses.
Now let's listen to some verses of the Holy Quran.
Insights into the Holy Quran by Sayyid Muhammad Hassan Mudarrisi, a graduate of the Hausa Seminary of Qom.
So all in all, they had three justifications and they had three reasonings, the chiefs of the polytheists and also the aristocrats. First, the prophets are normal human beings, basharam mithlukum. Second, he does not have any qualities over you, mithlakum. And a third is that following them is a total loss. Innakum idhan lakhasirun. Verily, you will be losers. So they try to mislead the people by these reasonings. And they actually denied resurrection by asking them this question. They told the people that if the prophet is giving you promises that you will be raised after you are completely dead and have become dust and bones, then if you follow them, you are really losers in this case. And then the third verse shows that the unbelievers did not accept the promises of their prophets in this regard. They were opposed to the possibility of returning back to life after complete annihilation in the earth. In fact, they believed that its occurrence was impossible. Hayhata, hayhata lima tu'aduna. Far, very far is what you are promised. This Quranic word hayhat is used in Quran twice, which is in this very verse. So it could be inferred from the repetition of the word in this verse that the elite among the unbelievers imagined that the resurrection was a very remote possibility indeed. And that's why they repeated this word, hayhat, hayhat alima tu'adu. Far and very far is what you are promised. And this is how they try to mislead people and tell them that if you follow them, you are consequently losers. Thank you, dear listeners, for staying with us in this program. Wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
Don't be saddened by what you see, by all the lies and treachery. Life is cruel, but don't worry. In your heart lies the key to unwind all the secrets. This life we see.
Thank you, dear listeners of IRIB English, for listening to us. If you have any question regarding our programs, feel free to email us at englishradio@irib.ir. Also, visit our website at parsetoday.com. Until the next program, take care and goodbye.
Our voice comes from the heart of beautiful Iran. This is the Heart of Life Pounding. IRIB English Radio.
Muhammad Al-Attar, a Palestinian teacher, has lost his wife and three children in an Israeli airstrike in his house in North Gaza Strip. Muhammad's four-story building that was a shelter for his entire family totally collapsed to the ground. Muhammad, who used to have a normal life, working at a school and looking after his kids, is now homeless and without a family.
Israeli airstrikes hit our building without any prior notice. I just opened my eyes and found all of us under the rubble. Some of us managed to get out of the rubble. I tried to save my children, but to no avail. I called for help from Civil Defense Service, but it took long till they reached us. I just want to ask the international community and human rights groups, what are our rights? I had a peaceful life and suddenly I became homeless without a family. I lost every hope I used to have.
Hassan Al-Attar, Muhammad's father-in-law, has his own sufferings to tell. Working in the Civil Defense Services, he was surprised with a call informing that his daughter, along with her three kids, were killed by Israeli airstrikes. Staring at the bodies of his daughter and her three children, Hassan bid farewell to his daughter while he was at work trying to pull their bodies from the rubble.
I was at work when Muhammad called me to tell that Israel bombed his house and my daughter and her three kids were under the rubble. They rented ambulances.
they were all out on missions, and I had to wait for one. When I got to them, their bodies were all out of the rubble. I don't know why Israel targeted them.
Most Gazans are in need of mental health support following the latest 11-day escalation that killed families in their homes in Gaza. The north parts of the Gaza Strip, along with Beit Hanun and Jabalia, was one of the areas that witnessed bombardment coupled with heavy artillery shelling. Hundreds of Palestinians, including women and children, were killed in the Israeli bombardment of the Gaza Strip in 11 days of the conflict that began on May 10. Israel's airstrikes also brought widespread devastation to the already impoverished territory. Palestinians here say the aggression has not undermined their will to stand against the occupation regime. They say despite their suffering, they will remain steadfast and fight for their rights. Ruba Shabet, Gaza.
Against the racist and Islamophobic far right, in defense of public and individual liberties, that's the main slogan of 140 marches that took place all over France, organized by more than 100 organizations and associations. The protesters say there is an urgency to stop the rise of far-right militias and parties in France that act more and more openly and in full impunity.
It's the first time that we see people producing videos with death threats and using real bullets in a killing setup. We didn't realize the nature of the danger that's rising in our country. The day after the video, the President of the Republic's been slapped in the face. I think that now many people are aware of the gravity of the situation.
Earlier this year, thousands of militaries, amongst them dozens of generals, openly called for law and order against the danger of Islamization of the French society. Earlier this week, a known far-right activist posted a video where he steps with a knife and shoots with real bullets a puppet representing progressive activists and calling for the murder of journalists and the left leader Mélenchon. One day later, a far-right activist slapped President Macron in the face, shouting a royalist slogan. But instead of facing a danger of a fascist putsch, the French government was occupied in endless debates in Parliament and Senate about separatism targeting directly the Muslim community or involving laws protecting the police.
The French government should be a barrier, but step by step it is becoming a bridge to the far right because the government is introducing in the public debate topics like migration and so-called separatism. There is clearly an authoritarian drift of the government, and all these issues pave the way for the far right.
The far right tries to introduce in France as a unique issue the Muslims and the insecurity. These are not the problems that we face. We face social and health problems. These are the real problems.
Protesters say that an authoritarian and racist drift in the French society is already taking place. This ideology is officially carried by the Marine Le Pen party. Instead of facing this danger, they say the French government is copying parts of the far-right program and is not making any concessions to the popular movement like the Yellow Vest protests. Presidential elections will take place in France in less than 1 year, and the odds of a racist and Islamophobic far-right leader taking the reins remain high. Christian Hunt, Paris.
For the last time, the seven presidential candidates stood toe-to-toe at the headquarters of Iran's national television, the IRIB, to face off for the third and final debate. While the debate was themed with people's concerns, it was derailed every once in a while toward other issues, such as foreign policy, a topic toward which the two camps of the principalists and the reformists have conflicting stances. The debate saw the two pro-reformist candidates, Abdel Nasser Hemati and Mohsen Mehralizadeh, stressing the need for Iran to join the Paris-based Financial Action Task Force, or the FATF, a global intergovernmental organization tasked with combating money laundering and terrorism financing. Iran and North Korea are the only two countries in the world that have not signed up for the FATF.
Mr. Jalili, only you and North Korea are saying that the FATF is useless. Are you saying the 200 countries around the world which signed the FATF do not understand that it's useful or not? The FATF is meant to contain money laundering and terrorism. Please think twice before making any comment.
Saeed Jalili, a heavyweight principalist, called Iran's entrance into the FATF an irreparable mistake that completes the puzzle of sanctions by the West and the U.S.
Entering into some international conventions is a mistake. You agree to enter into the FATF, but then they will decide the next step for you.
But he did not elaborate on his stance during the debate. Along with other journalists, I waited outside the debate studio to investigate his take on the FATF and how he would treat the international convention, should he become the next Iranian president.
The Iranian government has already signed an action plan with the FATF. Rouhani has agreed that Iran implement 39 out of the 41 articles of the FATF. Iran did comply with those 39 articles, yet that organization has approved only 16 of them. Furthermore, the FATF has made an announcement that if Iran fulfills the entire 41 articles, still it would define the next step for the country. Iranians need to know about these facts.
As part of Iran's action plan with the FATF, initially agreed upon more than 6 years ago, the country had to finalize four pieces of legislation. Two were passed by a reformist-dominated parliament, but the incumbent principalist-heavy parliament has halted the approval of the two remaining bills and referred them to the arbitration body, the Expediency Council, whose secretary is another presidential runner, Mohsen Rezai. Rezai says any decision regarding the FATF now is tied to whether the U.S. would lift its anti-Iran sanctions as part of the ongoing Vienna talks between Iran and the parties to the nuclear deal over the revival of the 2015 accord. This is how the upcoming presidential election could shape Iran's foreign policy. Iranians will go to polls on June 18th to choose their next president.
While many Iranians are still undecided on a single candidate, the debates have helped them to narrow down their choices. But the question of who will be the next Iranian president will be answered on June 18th. Yusuf Jalali, Tehran.
To mark the 2,000 days of the detention of Sheikh Zazaki, the Islamic movement in Nigeria issued a statement expressing concern over the continuous detention of the Islamic cleric, but most especially the silence of other Nigerians over this injustice. In December 2015, Sheikh Zazaki was arrested by security forces following an attack on his home and worship center, where hundreds of his supporters were killed by soldiers. The statement by the Islamic movement said the silence of those who are supposed to condemn the injustice is more painful than the jubilation of the oppressors.
The masses should know that if today is Sheikh Zazaki, tomorrow it may be you. If you are a Christian and the government is detaining the Sheikh, well, you want to kill the Sheikh because he doesn't practice the same ideology in Islam with them. What about you that you are a Christian? You should come out and join hand and fight against injustice and say no to injustice and oppression.
For over 5 years, members of the Islamic movement have been coming out to protest, seeking for the release of Sheikh Zazaki, but the Nigerian government has kept a deaf ear. Over 300 supporters of Sheikh Zazaki were killed and dumped in a mass grave without proper identification and funeral prayers. This and the attack on Sheikh Zazaki and his supporters, according to the Islamic movement, were despicable and unacceptable.
That is the worst that has happened in the history of Africa, where a detachment of army of a country will launch an attack to a bona fide citizen of an innocent citizen to his house is the worst crime against humanity in the history of Africa.
Sheikh Ibrahim al-Zazaki is spending close to 6 years in detention. The Islamic movement in Nigeria called on the Nigerian authorities to comply with the Federal High Court order and release Sheikh Zazaki and his wife Zainab. Tanjim Abdullahi, Abuja.
As the G7 descended on Cornwall for the summit, thousands of passionate pro-Palestine protesters amassed outside Downing Street in central London on Saturday to vent their anger over ongoing Israeli crimes against the Palestinians.
These protesters are absolutely furious at the lack of action from world leaders following Israel's recent and relentless attacks on Gaza and the Al-Aqsa Mosque compound. Although a ceasefire has been agreed since then. The fact that Palestinians are still forced to live under an apartheid regime has bitterly fueled the anger of these protesters who want to force a change.
Protesters had various demands, including international recognition of the Palestinian state and an end to Israeli arms sales.
If arms are used in violation of international law, they must be banned, embargoed immediately. Also, the issue of settlement products, they must be banned immediately. Those are illegal products. The recognition of the state of Palestine is long overdue. We do not understand why the UK government is not even listening to the voices of its own people, the voices of its own parliament that voted overwhelmingly to recognize the state of Palestine. The lack of recognition is not only immoral, it is undemocratic.
Place an embargo on Israel. Stop the arms deal. So this is the message that we're sending to. The people are with us. We're in our thousands. And we are going to continue until, honestly, the Palestinians are free and occupation is ended.
We are not going to forget the mark of shame upon the history of this country that brought us to where we are today, the Balfour Declaration. We demand a public apology from the British government as well as recognition of our state of Palestine. On top of that, we want sanctions now. We want justice. We want action.
The bombs may have temporarily stopped falling, but while Israel's systematic discrimination against the Palestinian people continues, so will the protests. Robert Carter, London.
The head of Iran's delegation to nuclear talks in Vienna, Deputy Foreign Minister Abbas Araghchi, says there are still many technicalities that need to be resolved before a final agreement can be reached. Iran and the remaining signatories of the nuclear deal known as the JCPOA have been engaged in talks to bring the US back into the deal and to ensure Iran's full compliance since April. Iran says it will only implement its nuclear commitments after it verifies the effective removal of all US sanctions, including additional ones imposed under former President Donald Trump, who withdrew from the deal in 2018. Iran is seeking assurances the U.S. will not do so again.
They have to ensure the Islamic Republic of Iran that what happened in the past is not going to be repeated itself in the future. For that, we need lots of political, legal, and technical discussions. We continue these discussions and these talks as long as needed.
Russian envoy Mikhail Ulyanov said the differences of opinion between Iran and the U.S. are not many, but they are of principal character. The main unresolved issue at this stage, he said, is how the agreement will be implemented, who will do what, and when. The EU, which acts as coordinator, said the sides are making progress, but that negotiations are intense on a number of remaining issues.
The EU will continue with the talks with all the participants to the JCPOA and separately with the United States to find ways to get very close to a final agreement in the coming days. Thank you.
Araghchi said he did not think the sides could come to a final conclusion in this round, adding that Iran would continue negotiations as long as necessary and until its key concerns were addressed. Homar Izgi, Vienna.
Iran has unveiled a book titled Golan. The book discusses the importance of the Golan Heights, from where Israel monitors developments in Syria after its occupation, so it does not tend to lose its control. Speaking at the unveiling ceremony, the Syrian ambassador to Tehran said that to Syrians, the Golan Heights is as important as the Gaza Strip.
We thank and appreciate the publication of such an important book on the Golan Heights. We thank the author of the book, the Palestine Committee of Iran's presidential office, as well as Iraq's Al-Nujaba Islamic Resistance Movement for publishing the book on the anniversary of the Israeli occupation of the Golan Heights, especially when Israel prevented Syrian inhabitants of the Golan Heights to take part in the election. Syria has always stood by Palestine, and the enemy knows that for us every single inch of our homeland is as important as the whole country, and we are always prepared to pay any price to protect our territorial integrity.
This book's the result of my research and studies on the importance of the Golan Heights for the Zionist regime's national security strategy.
This book has two parts. The first part discusses the ideology of occupation, and the second part talks about the military and non-military specifications of the Golan region, because the Golan Heights overlook the four surrounding countries of Lebanon, Syria, Palestine, and even Jordan, so it has a special geopolitical importance for Israel.
Meanwhile, Palestinian ambassador to Tehran, for his part, thanked Islamic Republic of Iran for publishing such a significant book, saying Syria has always stood by Palestine.
Syria has paid a heavy price for supporting Palestine. We share a common history. The 1965 revolution in Palestine was generated with the support of Syria, for which Syria came under numerous Israeli attacks. Syrians have offered many martyrs on this path, and we believe that they will finally liberate the Golan Heights from the Israeli occupation.
The Golan Heights has a special geopolitical, strategic, economic, military, and tourism importance for Israel. Therefore, the occupation of the Golan has continued the survival of the regime. But today, the resistance forces have become so powerful that Israel, which claims to have the world's fourth largest army, has surrendered the Gaza War.
In 1967, Israel waged a full-scale war against Arab territories, during which it occupied a large swathe of Golan and annexed it 4 years later, a move never recognized by the international community. In 1973, another war broke out, and a year later, a UN-brokered ceasefire came into force, according to which Tel Aviv and Damascus agreed to separate their troops and create a buffer zone in the Heights. But Israel has over the past decades built dozens of settlements in the Golan Heights in defiance of international calls for the regime to stop its illegal construction activities.
Syria has repeatedly reaffirmed its sovereignty over the Golan Heights, saying the territory must be completely restored to its control. This comes as the United Nations has emphasized Syria's sovereignty over the Golan Heights. Saman Kujuri, Tehran.
Two Iranian naval vessels are sailing across the South Atlantic Ocean in southwest of the African continent. The two warships have sailed for up to 12,000 kilometers over a course of a month now and are bound for North Atlantic. Deputy Coordinator for Iran's Army, Rear Admiral Habibullah Sayari, made the announcement on Thursday, saying this is the farthest point that an Iranian warship has ever sailed to.
For the first time, our Navy is sailing such a longest route. Over the past days, our ships have passed by Cape of Good Hope, rounded Africa, and now that are sailing at this point, they will sail on to reach North Atlantic.
The mission is carried out using two domestically built vessels, Sahand Frigate and Macron Floating Base. Fitted with a large helicopter pad, Macron was formerly used as an oil tanker. Sahand Frigate is a radar evading vessel that's equipped with torpedo launchers and electronic warfare technologies. The long journey comes as U.S. officials have claimed that Iran's Navy cannot operate in, quote, blue water. By blue water navies, the U.S. military means the ones that are capable of sailing in open ocean at great distances from their home countries and can operate for extended periods.
When we announced that we would sail in the Atlantic Ocean, some countries said that Iran does not possess such a capability. But today, the Iranian army displayed its naval might by dispatching the 77th Squadron to remote waters using its own fully indigenous vessels.
In 2008, leader of Iran's Islamic Revolution, Ayatollah Sayyid Ali Khamenei, hailed the Iranian army's navy as a strategic force. The navy then defined new roles and missions for itself. Among them was to expand its presence in the high seas and remote waters, advance maritime diplomacy, and ensure the safety of Iranian trade vessels by maintaining its presence in the Gulf of Aden.
This is the first time Iran's naval ships have set sail this far in open seas. Iranian officials say this is a turning point for the country's naval force, which will help ensure safer maritime trade around the world. Yusuf Jalali, Tehran.
It's been called the Sausage War, a dispute between the EU and former member UK about chilled meats, among other things, entering the bloc through Northern Ireland. The Brexit divorce deal signed by Prime Minister Boris Johnson kept Northern Ireland in the single market while it withdrew the rest of the UK. To avoid major disruptions caused by a hard border between Northern Ireland and the Republic of Ireland and potentially jeopardizing the Good Friday Agreement, the two sides negotiated the Northern Ireland Protocol, creating the Irish Sea border. At the time, Prime Minister Boris Johnson described it an excellent deal.
So Boris Johnson lied. What compounds this disaster more than any of the other disasters emanating from Brexit is the fact that we're talking about the resurgence possibly of conflict in that part of the world. 30 years troubles ending with the Good Friday Agreement in 1998, and that agreement is now imperiled.
The Northern Ireland Protocol allows checks to be done between Britain and Northern Ireland instead. That means British food products such as meat and milk arriving in Northern Ireland go through border checks to ensure they meet EU standards. But the new system got off to a shaky start. In early February, the EU complained that some goods were entering Northern Ireland without being checked properly. In March, the UK decided to unilaterally extend the six-month grace period on British chilled meats, sausages included, until October. That angered Brussels, who said the extension broke international law and threatened legal action.
Because they understand that this will be playing well for Boris Johnson politically in his Brexit heartlands, so they need to make sure that people know in Britain that they are negotiating in good faith and they're doing their best to make this work. They're willing to go to the nth degree to do so, and they think probably that will highlight how Boris Johnson is not playing an honest hand here.
The UK's Brexit minister, Lord Frost, and his EU peer, Mara Sefcovic, are meeting in London on June 9th to discuss the implementation of the Northern Ireland Protocol, with the EU side saying the Commission would not tolerate further failures of compliance by London.
The UK say that the EU is being too strict about implementing the deal, that Europe is hardly going to be flooded with meat through Northern Ireland. The EU, on the other hand, say they're trying to be helpful, but if Boris Johnson doesn't like the deal, he shouldn't have signed it. Saeed Bouriza, London.
You ask me, why do I stand here so unafraid of everything around me? Proudly I would say, I am a Muslim. If you ask her, why does she dress that way, all covered up in a world that gives it all away? Proudly she would say, I am a Muslim.
Islamic laws.
If you ask him, why does he still pray 5 times a day when so many others have strayed, smiling he would say, I am a Muslim.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim, in the name of God. Welcome to the program Islamic Laws on RIB English Radio with me, Muhammad Javad, hosting this program. And sitting in the studio along with me, Sheikh Javid, well, the dear guest speaker in this program, Islamic Laws. Welcome to the program, Sheikh Javid.
Thank you very much. Thank you for having me.
The pleasure is ours. Stay tuned. We'll be back. We're going to talk about ghusl, or the ritual bath, according to Ayatollah Sistani. Before that, let's take a listen to a short biography.
The Grand Ayatollah Sistani comes from the family of scholars and pious men. He learned theological and rational sciences from many eminent and well-known religious scholars. At the age of 5, His Eminence started learning the Holy Quran. He was then admitted in a religious center for reading, writing, and for learning basic mathematics and geography. In the beginning of 1360 Hijri, he started studying basic Hawza lessons. He also studied a number of books on philosophy like Sharh Manzuma Sabzawari and Sharh Ashraq. Meanwhile, he attended Kharij lectures by the late Mirza Mehdi Ashtiani and the late Mirza Hashim Qazvini. In the late 1368 Hijri, he migrated to Qum to accomplish his studies in fiqh and usul. His Eminence left Qum for Najaf al-Ashraf. On having arrived in Najaf, he began attending Qayatullah Khoi and Sheikh Hussain Hilli's lectures in